I hope this afternoon we might explore together the idea that cities are among the or become more compelling to us if we consider not only their physicality, but when we think about the social dynamics of cities and think about perhaps the social energy that is part of city life and both the building of cities as well as their sustaining. I consider as a foundational a claim, I suppose, that philosophy is a means of exploring ideas. Philosophy is not sort of just passive, but it's also a means of structuring how we might engage with the world around us. So today I'm going to ask make five statements. I'm going to give you some illustrations. Then I'm going to end each piece with a question to hang on to, and I hope that can be sufficient to foster for us the conversation that will follow. In the absence of PowerPoint, that perennially present but often irritating part of communications these days, I have foregone that and gone to a more old medium, paper with images on it. So as I go through to the five pieces, I'm going to hand around some images and things that you can kind of look at. I'm really interested in being able to see and do and touch things. So in the spirit of that, I'll sort of pass these pictures around as it's appropriate. So let me start by talking about a TV series that was among my most favorite. It's no longer broadcast. They've completed it. But the History Channel had a fantastic thought experiment that was really intriguing. And it was called Life After People. Anybody ever watch Life After People? If you're interested in cities, if you're interested in the things that humans build and culture, it's a really interesting way of engaging in that old philosophical habit and practice of devising thought experiments to ask what if. What if this happened? What if that happened? And to play out a scenario. In Life After People, History Channel made an assumption. Earth, population, zero. And then it said, now we're going to start. We're not going to ask the question, why did people disappear? What was the apocalypse? Were people sort of taken off by aliens? They don't care. They simply start with the point and say, Earth, population, zero. Now start the clock ticking. And let's see and imagine what happens. In the scenarios that they play out, they usually pick a particular city, and then they start saying, okay, day one. So one day after people disappear, what happens in the city? And not much. Really, there's not a lot that's going on. Maybe day seven, and then they go back and they visit and see what's happening. And then they'll say week two, week five, month three, the third month, the sixth month, and move it forward and start to ask the question, what happens to the city as an artifact once the humans disappear, once there's no longer the sustaining presence of people among them? I'm going to hand around here. There's three pictures. I tried to select images that I think are clear enough to know what exactly, which city it is in mind that they have, and what entropy has started to do with some of those cities. There's no particular order. You can just circulate them wherever people can look at them. Here's a few comments about that. What happens when there's no longer people on Earth and no longer people to attend to our cities? First of all, entropy begins to immediately have its way. So cities start to wind down or else they change their order. So air conditioning systems that required humans to attend to, or electrical grids or water pumps, all of those sorts of things are buildings that required constant maintenance and attention, start to fall apart and crumble. Some of them start to show signs of immediate weakness days, even hours, after people no longer attend to them. Other structures don't start falling down and crumbling until 100 years or 200 years after people have disappeared. It's really kind of an engineer's scenario. What breaks first? Why does it break? What happens when water starts leaking into high-rise buildings? What happens when the pumps that keep much of Washington, D.C. dry quit running? What begins to flood? What begins to fall down? It's an ecologist's lab as well, because you begin to see nature starting to kind of creep back in. So birds start to live in the high rises. Plants in the southern U.S. start overgrowing buildings. You see natural issues of storm damage and other things no longer being attuned and adjusted to by people. It continues to have its way, and you see various parts of city infrastructure falling apart. Roads no longer look like roads. They start looking like sort of tree pathways, and eventually they become indistinguishable from the natural landscape around it. 200 years after Manhattan, or after people disappear, Manhattan looks like kind of a hilly, rolling, green landscape. most everything has either fallen down or it's been overgrown to the point where you would almost not be able to distinguish it from the landscape around it. This is a thought experiment. We don't really know what would happen, but it's a start down that kind of down that path, which is useful. So the question that's been raised, what's happened to our conception of the city? I want to focus in particular on the human dimension of the city. The city is a social space. The city is a social phenomenon, not only as a physical thing, but as something that is about us in a primary sense as social beings. So here's my first statement. Cities require social energy to function, and they also generate that social energy. So that's an odd combination of terms, thinking of social energy, but it's hopefully we'll cohere as we kind of walk through these five pieces. As you've seen from the opening illustration, cities without people are artifacts. They become sort of physical entities that are subject to the various natural forces around us. But cities with people in them are an entirely different kind of phenomenon. We see something very peculiar when we have built environments with humans occupying them. Some of the questions include cities' capability of increasing social interaction. So we see that as an advantage of cities. Why do we gather in socially dense areas? Why do we connect? Why do we try to kind of stitch together all of the differences that are part of society in these things we call cities? There must be some advantage in doing so. So that increase in density is an important feature. Cities change social interaction. So we see the differences between people experiencing cities or experiencing their social lives in very sort of confined and maybe limited ways changing as they participate in city life. And in some cases we're learning today, cities may actually decrease social interaction. So social isolation looks to be an increasing phenomena that we're trying to come to terms with and understand exactly what is it about our cities in some cases that actually drives higher levels of social isolation. There's a new documentary out that some of you may or may not have seen, and I'm going to pass this around. It's called The Human Scale. Anybody heard about that? Andreas Dalsgaard was the documentary filmmaker that produced it. And in it, he asked the question about what part of human life in cities is being improved by the way we design our cities, and what parts of human interaction are actually suffering as a result of the way that we design our cities. His work is based on Jan Gehl's book called Cities for People. I'll pass that around as well. Hopefully these aren't distracting to you, but kind of just give you something to look at and give you a bit of artifact reference as we're walking through this. In both of these, the question is, if cities are designed for people, if they're designed for human flourishing, how are we doing in the design of our cities? Are they actually facilitating human interaction, human being, or are they in some cases mitigating against the very things that we need as human beings? One of the things he looks at is the way in which cities that we love best. If I polled the audience and said, what parts of a given city, maybe Edmonton, or what parts of the global cities that you've experienced do you love the most? Which ones are the most kind of attractive to us? Which ones feature the most often in our references to a great place to visit, a great place to live? Jan Gehl and Andreas Dalsgaard would argue that they're the places that are most tuned to the human scale, that they're most tuned to the social dynamic that we seek and that we want. We want diversity, we want something interesting, but it has to be at a scale and a size that we can actually manage and kind of work with, and that leads to our own sense of flourishing. So he cites examples of Italian cities, and he says, why are some Italian squares sought after globally? He says it's because they have organize their space and their features in certain ways that makes the human interaction, the social energy, in a sense, most prolific. And we are drawn to that and gravitate to it. So the question is, what metaphors dominate our modern ideas of the city today? So that could be one that we can discuss. What are the dominant metaphors for cities today? Are they economic engines? Do they have some sort of productive feature? In other words, the goods they produce, their exports, their outputs, the sheer number of people in them. What is it about cities, the metaphor of cities that we have today, that is useful and perhaps at some points troubling? So cities require social energy to function, and we can ask ourselves what metaphors attend to that functioning today. A second point is that social energy requires diverse, both diverse and persistent social ties. So one of the things we value in city life is that we have close connections, but that we also have a range of diverse and interesting connections to people that are different than we are. So we need in our social flourishing both diverse and persistent ties to each other. The challenge is this. If our ties are almost all diverse and very few of them are close, we have a very sort of disconnected feeling life. Our isolation is high. If we have an incredibly connected network of people around us with very low diversity, then we have a kind of insular life. And somewhere in between there, cities are brokering against that, or they're contributing to it one way or another, but the physical design of cities is not neutral in that respect. There's a great study. It's called Why the Garden Club Couldn't Save Youngstown. I don't know if anybody has seen it. It's an MIT paper. And it was put out some years ago. And it asked the question, two American steel towns, about the same size, not too far from each other, one of them Allenstown and one of them Youngstown, and the two cities adopted two different strategies post-steel collapse. One of them flourished, and one of them did not. And the question was, could a research team or could a group of researchers try to understand the role that the social fabric of the city played in each case in leading either to its flourishing or to its continued decline? And so what they did in Allenstown and in Youngstown was they did a survey of the how dense the social institutional connections were in each city. And then they did a comparison of what they looked like. So 1950, and then they looked at them in 1975, some years later, and tried to see if there was any noticeable pattern between the two. Here's the perhaps counterintuitive result that they discovered. The city that had the most tight, close, well-developed civic and institutional connections did much more poorly post-industrial collapse than the city that had a more loose and diverse network of connections. So I'm going to pass around what are, in a sense, almost like forensic slides of the social landscape of the two communities. And you can look through them in detail. Now, I'll hold up one, for example. But you can see at the top, that's the Allentown's economic and civic organization circa 1950. You'll get to see this, so my apologies for those of you for whom that is an indecipherable image. But the top one you can see just by a general sort of sense that it is a less dense network. And the one in the bottom is much more interconnected. And that's the one that performed the most poorly in terms of the changes that they needed to adjust to coming out of their coming out of the collapse. So there's a series here of four slides that I've got for you. Again, you can just sort of pass over them and take a look at them out of interest. The question I'd like to leave us in this section with is, how diverse or dense are social ties in our cities today? You could think of Edmonton. We can speak about it more generally. But would you say that our ties, are they increasing in their density? Are they increasing in their diversity? Are they changing perceptibly? And what is the impact on our cities? Social energy requires both diversity and intensity, connectedness and kind of spanning across the spaces. And so how are we doing today? What's your read of what's going on in that space? Third point. Institutions and organizations are a technology for harnessing and intensifying social energy. So institutions and organizations in cities are a way of intensifying and directing social energy, our connections to each other. So organizations, in a sense, are could be thought of as entities that enable things that individual effort can't accomplish on its own. So we can't do many things alone that we can actually pursue together. Institutional memory requires collective practice in many cases. Certain types of traditions can't be passed just one person to one person, but must be groups of people passing them on to other groups of people. City building itself can't function as a sole project, but must embody many groups and clusters of people. I don't know if you have had opportunity to read any of Herbert Simon's work, The Architecture of Complexity, 1961-1962. He's a very kind of, not exactly the sort of guy who looks like you would invite him to a party, but this is Herbert Simon playing chess, and I'll pass that photo around as I read a brief quote from him. This is what Herbert Simon had to say about social systems, so the social energy and patterning that we see present in cities, both historically and today. This is what Simon said. I've already given an example of one kind of hierarchy that is frequently encountered in the social sciences, a formal organization. Business firms, governments, universities all have a clearly visible parts within parts structure. But formal organizations are not the only or even the most common kind of social hierarchy. Almost all societies have elementary units called families, which may be grouped into villages or tribes, and these into larger groupings and so on. If we make a chart of social interactions, of who talks to whom, the clusters of dense interaction in the chart will identify a rather well-defined hierarchic structure. The groupings in this structure may be defined operationally by some measure of frequency of interaction in this sociometric matrix. So in 1961, Simon is picking up the fact and sort of translating that paragraph that if we could see the pattern of social connections in cities, we would see some parts that are quite lumpy and dense. We would see other areas that are quite thin and sparsely populated. And the very character of those interactions and those patterns would have a significant shaping in the life of people who are part of that city or part of those social settings. So the question on this front is, are institutions and organizations changing at a core level today? Is there anything about the social change that we're seeing today in cities that is in any way different than the kinds of changes we've seen in cities over the centuries and millennia? Is it accelerating? Is it slowing down? Or are there fundamental shifts in the way that we're seeing that the lumpiness or the patterns of those social interactions changing? Are the institutions and organizations in those spaces actually becoming quite different than anything we may have seen in the past? Point number four, city leaders, this is maybe the most off-the-edge assertion, but city leaders remain primitive in their understanding of social energy. So our awareness of that social patterning, how it's changing, why it's changing, where it may be leading, remains at a preliminary, primitive, or kind of early understanding level. We're not that good yet at really understanding what's happening in that space and how it impacts life in cities. Social patterns are both obvious in some sense, and in other ways they're notoriously difficult to understand. They are the invisible connections among us. They are not simple to understand. They're difficult to see with any regularity. And yet they remain one of the more deeply shaping aspects of our life together. Anecdotes about our experience in cities are helpful, but they don't give us the broad patterns that we sometimes need. Statistics can be useful for the broad patterns. They don't always give us a sense of the particularities that we need in the given situations in which we work and live. There's a new book out by Alex Pentland. I don't know if any of you follow MIT's, some of their work, Sensible Cities and their Media Lab work. But Pentland's got a new book out that kind of covers the last 10 years or so of the MIT research work that's been done. And so he's put out a new book called Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread the Lessons from a New Science. And Pentland is very optimistic that if we could see this social data more and more clearly, we will actually be able to solve the problems that we face. In fact, he goes so far as to suggest that if we could harness all of this big data, we would likely usher in a new era of world peace and cooperation. He's far more optimistic than I am in that regard, because I also am aware of a paper or a book written by a couple of guys in the mid-1800s when the telegraph was first becoming prominent, and actually when the first cable was laid across the Atlantic, who felt that this new cross-continental, cross-oceanic connection would be the means by which the world would now end its wars, where people would begin to understand each other, and that we were now on the cusp of actually settling the long-standing problem of human warfare. So we kind of know how that turned out. It wasn't quite as good. The 20th century did have a small bit of fighting, conflict, and war in it. But we hear similar sentiments now being spoken by Pentland, who sees this notion of social physics being kind of the holy grail by which we will solve our problems through careful social engineering. So anyway, that's... If we're primitive in our understanding, I think it's also the case that there's much yet to debate about what role our understanding of social connectedness can play in developing better cities and solving some of our perennial problems. So let me ask this question, and I'll move quickly to my last point. If the sum of what is knowable about the social dynamics of cities is a nice, crisp apple pie, so if all we can know about it is this nice, sort of large, fresh apple pie, how many pieces are we in terms of our understanding that space? So of what is knowable, what might be discerned about the social dynamics of cities and the patterns therein, of all of the possible knowledge we might have about that, how far are we along the way? Do we have half a pie? Are we one slice in? Have we almost completely eaten the pie that we're just closing in on the final details? Finally, if we talk about social energy, if we think about how those patterns of density of connection or thinness of connection play out, if we think about the fact that organizations and institutions are expressions of our connecting together socially, then in light of this lecture series examination, the question is the role that religion and faith-based organizations play in city landscapes and their role in that social dynamic. Is it a positive role? Is it a negative role? Will it remain persistent? How will it play itself out in our cities in the future? Is it the kind of thing that we should at some point expect will fade away and that we will no longer have to deal with? Or is it in fact something more central and critical to what it means to be human, to be social, and to be connected to each other over time? Religious expression is, of course, very complex. It's very diverse. It's global. It also has extremely local expressions. But we recognize that cities and religion are integrally connected. I leave, I think this is my last image. This is from National Geographic from a couple years back. The cover story was about Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. And this is an archaeological find that was particularly intriguing to me because it raised the question, the standard archaeological kind of direction was, humans began to intensify their connections, began to organize, settle, pursue agriculture and other sorts of domestic practices, leaving room for things like writing and the development of other technologies. And out of that, then, religion came. When there was enough leisure time, we kind of got around to organized religion. Göbekli Tepe turns that question on its head and seems to suggest that there was first the organizing of religion that led to this formation of this particular artifact in this site, and that it flips the order. Religion led to domestication, intensification, and civilization. Now, it's a debated theory, but as credible a source as National Geographic has taken it seriously enough to publish a paper, an article in it. I'll pass that around. And its particular interest is the age of it, how early it is, how developed it is, and it challenges our notion about integrally religious faith is tied to our cities. So here's the question on this point. Would our cities be better off without religious organizations and institutions? Have we outgrown them? And is our modern sort of technological move forward, modern advancements across all fronts, eventually going to make them unnecessary? That it's not a permanent or central feature of our connections to each other or to our human being, but is actually something that we will eventually outgrow and move past. Many, of course, have argued for that, but I'll raise that as a closing question as well. I'm at my time limits as far as at least asking some questions. They will all not be equally clear, but hopefully there's a few in there that might be of interest to you, and I would certainly welcome hearing from you and, of course, your discussions amongst yourselves. Thank you.
So just a little reminder, whoever would like to enter in first and speak to some aspect of this that Milton's laid before us, I would appreciate it if those who want to build on that particular theme or issue, just let me know and I'll come to you. And then at a certain point, we'll move on to another avenue of exploration. So, who's interested in thinking about this off the top? Tony, I'm surprised that you actually are going to think about this.
Testing. Thanks very much. I decided to try and go first just to get my comments out the way and let more intelligent ones from other people follow, actually. But it just seemed to me, and I very much enjoyed your presentation there, but it seemed to me there was one word which was conspicuously absent from your presentation, and that was the word community. And it could well be that you implied it when you were talking about social energy of the cities and social interactions and things like that. But the term community, I think, is essential if we're talking about human life in the cities. Because if you go back to some of the classic authors who've written about the city, like Lewis Mumford or Jane Jacobs and others that came after, they were very much concerned with the issue of community in cities. And the reason I'd like to mention it is because it connects with a couple of other things I think that you said. Because we know today that large cities in various parts of the world are afflicted by very serious problems of drugs, of gangs, of poverty and destitution, and so on and so forth, racial violence. And we know that cities which have traditionally had a sense of community before these communities have been eclipsed by various forms of urban renewal and modernization. What does a community mean in the city? It means a neighborhood which watches out for itself. It means people keep an eye open for themselves, often because they're unable to do that ecologically. They live close together. They're often within eyeshot or earshot of each other. And attempts to resuscitate a sense of community, for example, with the police trying to introduce community policing programs, is an attempt to appeal to those latent structures within the city which can look out for each other. And we know that there has been a strong correlation between well-organized communities and the reduction of crime, because drug dealers and prostitutes and muggers find it much more difficult to operate in a zone that people take responsibility for each other, look out for each other. So I'd like to make that point. I'd also connect with something else you said when you went back to social physics. Because one of the big problems I think we have, not only with cities, but within other aspects of our lives, is what I would call the hubris of technology, the belief that urban planners, that technocrats know best how to redesign cities. And when we see huge apartment blocks going up, which break up the natural ecology of a city, which makes it far more difficult for people to watch out for each other, we are creating urban wastelands where once there were active, vibrant neighborhoods. And one of the big middle class I think, prejudices is to believe that in a poor neighborhood you can't have a community. In fact, it's quite the opposite. In many poor neighborhoods, before they were gutted by urban renewal, before the huge projects, as they call them in the US, or estates, as they call them in Britain, went up, even though these areas were poor, they were often well organized in a kind of sociological sense. I remember spending some time in Oakland, you know, outside of San Francisco, being amazed at the degree of interaction between householders, and where the houses were very small, the interaction would spill out into the street and the street became part of the house. There was socializing done, cups of coffee were brought out, people interacted in a very organized way. So I guess what I'm saying is, and we've experienced in Canada, Africville in Halifax once was a well-organized, although lower class, if you like, lower income, racialized neighborhood, but it was well organized. When the developers came in, up went the high rises, the sense of community was fractured, the sense of community was totally eclipsed, and we were left with the kind of wasteland that now exists in Africa, Africville. So in conclusion, what am I saying? And I'm not sure if you're going to agree with this part. We need to nationalize urban building land. We need to get rid of the corporate developers whose only interest is profit and accumulation of wealth, who put up retail stores and shopping malls, irrespective of what it does to the local ecology. We need to place some kind of power and social action back into the hands of the people who live in these areas. We need to nationalize urban building land. We need to impose rent controls. In other words, we need to decommodify these areas and give it back to the people who actually live there.
A couple of quick comments, and then others may want to respond. I know it's not, you know, here just to listen to me. Well, amongst my sort of scattered thoughts, half-baked ideas in the preceding 20-25 minutes, one of the orienting motivations for me in looking at some of these questions was I live in East Hamilton. I'm a newcomer there, so I just moved there in 2008 from Calgary, and one of the first early questions that came to me was, what is the social landscape of Hamilton look like? Because I live in East Hamilton. There's a kind of prejudice against East Hamilton. It's a lower economic area. It's older. It's a bit more run down. It's not suburban. And yet, living there, walking there, and then raising my family, there was a strong sense in which the connectedness of people was actually quite good. And in fact, though our realtor said, surely you're not going to even look for a house in that part of the city, we did, and it has been one of the best places we've ever lived in terms of the quality of life and our connection there. But a typical kind of mapping of the city, you'd see socioeconomic kind of standard practice. This area's average income is here, this one's is here, ergo this is a better area. When in fact, the social connectedness was stronger and the sense of cooperation was higher amongst some of those other areas. And so my question was, instead of just the standard measures of what sort of constitutes well-being in the city using economic and typical indicators that way, what about the measure of how sort of socially connected people are, how their sense of belonging and what that looks like? And if we can't see that, we can't really protect it. We can't argue for it from a policy vantage point. And so then we end up falling back to kind of the typical measures. Many of them that would reflect the values you suggest are problematic, which is, you know, developers look at this area and say its economic potential is this, and that's the only consideration. Let's build. The social will somehow take care of itself. In fact, the social infrastructure article I wrote for Municipal World was drawing attention to the fact that perhaps the social infrastructure question is more critical and may actually need to precede some of the physical infrastructure questions. They're both needed. So cities without people, that doesn't work. People without any infrastructure, you can't have cities. You have to have both. But thinking about the social infrastructure changes the question potentially to kind of set up a space where questions like you're raising or policy changes would be more amenable or more possible, where it's not the quick predetermined reaction to the typical kind of frameworks that are currently in place. In short, I don't think we pay enough attention to the social infrastructure in our cities, including the institutions, organizations, and communities that we talk about. I don't use communities as much because in some circles, people will dismiss you, shorthand. There's so much talk of communities, community. I'm kind of stepping back a notch and talking about a more fundamental kind of infrastructure question. And so I'm happy to use community, but I often try to find other words as well to use it. So, but in spirit, yes, on the same track.
I think we agree on a lot of things. My final comment would be I think that I am a fervent believer in the power of community, in the sense that a well-organized neighborhood has a lot going for it. At the same time, I'm not a religious person, but in answer to your question, what's the role of religion?
Tony, you're a fundamentalist communist. Come on.
Oh, you're right, of course. How come that has escaped my mind? I think one of the roles for secular religions or theological religions is, unfortunately, many well-organized neighborhoods in the past have had a downside. If ever you've been to South Boston, you'll find that the Irish community there is one of the most racist communities you ever want to go to. And I'm sure you'd find Italian neighborhoods and Portuguese and other neighborhoods. Sometimes well-organized communities with embedded traditions can be very resistant to what they regard as outsiders. Part of the role of a religion, I think, is to make those ethnic boundaries far more porous and to enable a much more inclusive attitude to be set. Like Mayor Nenshi, for example, in Calgary, I think has played some kind of a role in that. So I don't think we should underestimate the importance of helping these communities to modernize in an inclusive and democratic sense.
So you think of that?
I think what would be interesting is if we could more regularly see, and the patterns I showed you of Allenstown and Youngstown, and showing how the civic patterns of organization, for instance, are either really dense or more loosely kind of spread out, would it be of any use in a city like Edmonton to be able to see that kind of mapping of densities, cross-connectedness? Would it be helpful in identifying places perhaps that are so insular they do not have that sort of porous sense, and therefore there may be challenges in terms of their function within the city? I mean, every group requires both an insider and outsider kind of calculus of some kind, right? Otherwise, we don't have a group. There has to be some definition. But some of those boundaries can be so drawn so tightly that we begin to see the difficulties that come from them. So if they're so insular, so interconnected, they begin to develop what we see as a kind of deep prejudice against anything other than what's inside that group. And yet if they're so loose that every entity has very few meaningful connections, we see another problem, which we're seeing in a major medical study, the whole Lundstedt meta-analytics survey of social isolation and mortality, which showed that over the last 20 years, Americans, adults, who cite they have no significant confidant has gone up by a factor of 3. You might say, well, who cares? You know, rent a movie, buy a book, you know, have a cup of coffee by yourself. What does that matter? Well, what they found was the chances of you dying prematurely if you're in that category is as significant as if you had heart disease, as heart disease or stroke or obesity. That kind of early mortality health impact. So social isolation is not benign. It's not like a luxury of some kind. The more isolated we are, so if there's not enough of that binding, we're seeing significant health effects that are starting to show up in a broad sense, not just in isolated pockets, but broadly speaking. I think that will be a public policy issue down the road. I think that will be an important health issue. And, of course, in the sense of human well-being, it's disturbing to think of that many, you know, the number of people who simply, because they don't have a place to belong and connect, are actually dying early and suffering as a result. That's a kind of thing that it seems that ought not to be. And for myself, is a fairly deep motivator in all the work I pursue to say, let's see that first. Is that true? Is it credible? Secondly, what might be done about that? Surely that's not an ideal state to say, let's just leave it. It will take care of itself. So.
I'd like to pick up on this discussion on community. I think there's different tools, but as someone in the industry, I'm going to posit cars are part of the challenge. I share the view that building more densified cities actually creates more isolation in some respects. And I think part of the problem is we drive everywhere. And so it's interesting to see a proposal in Calgary just being advanced now with a high-rise tower with no parking. I believe that we need to get, from a civic perspective, our head around the idea of providing transit that will create that sense of community, because at the very least, we will have to walk back and forth to the bus, to the train, to whatever it may be. And I believe that that creates an organic opportunity to actually meet and greet. And, you know, there's lots of songs that talk about that. It doesn't matter. But I think that I listened to a suggestion earlier of one tool. Another tool might be to collectively get our head around just the way that we treat the car and the way that we treat transit. And I believe that would help create community.
One of the interesting things that Jan Gehl talks about, and you'd see it show up as well in the Human Scale documentary, is the idea that it's very expensive to accommodate car culture, so it costs a lot. But he said it's actually not that expensive to be good to people. So returning some of our spaces to more human kind of functional spots where that mixing, crossing paths, he talks about, you know, the idea of the 2 to 3 to 4 mile per hour kind of exchange spaces that accommodate that as having a stronger social building capability than spaces where the mode of transit is, you know, 60 miles an hour plus. It's interesting that Le Corbusier was also very keen on this differentiation between the 3 mile per hour space of traffic flow and the 60 mile per hour. And, of course, now he's villainized for all of his sort of brutalist-looking types of approaches. But in many cases, Le Corbusier his ideas were only followed partially. They built the tower. They tried to separate the two modes of transit out. But I think he said more about this kind of idea that the interconnections of social building need to happen in that 3 mile an hour space, that buildings and the free park space that his towers would have given rise to or were supposed to give rise to were the very settings in which he thought that that would happen. So, you know, it's a long preoccupation of people looking at cities to balance these metabolisms of traffic, movement, and socialization. Because we do need some of these other infrastructures. I mean, there's just no way you and I have clothes, food, or anything else without semi-trailers and trains and inner ships. It's just not going to happen, even if we find them irritating. But whether we have to completely dismantle all of that to begin to move significantly towards creating better human and social interaction is, I don't think, it's not a dichotomy. It's not choose one or the other, but that we can begin to modify some of what we have in sometimes simple ways that facilitate this idea that you're, you know, that even in transit, could it help our socialization? That's a good question. We should think about that.
Well, I appreciate your thought about, you know, finding a way to get there. One of the things I'm working on is car share program within a standard condominium complex where at least if we could start by reducing the number of cars that come in and acknowledging the fact that a car is required once in a while. I went to a project that the World Wildlife Fund created in Bedshed just south of London where they have a car share program, and what happens is people get one hands the key off to the other and they actually by mistake meet each other. So there may be ways to slowly morph. You posed the question about mapping Edmonton and its connections. And I would suggest that it might be an interesting exercise, but we'll find that we're so married to our cars that we're going to need to find tools to move ourselves along the path. It's not going to be a yes-no discussion.
I think, just if I could say one thing, I think another word for community might be inconvenience. And that really, in some ways, to build community means you have to increase the social friction. So if we never have to encounter each other, if we never have to deal with each other, it's extremely low kind of social friction in a sense, and also consequently very low bonding and connecting and actually integrating. So we don't like that. So, I mean, our own cultural values tend towards, you know, autonomy, independence, lower the inconvenience threshold, but those of us are part of communities of one kind or another, and for many, even the practice of religious communities certainly clearly shows you that part of the discipline required is to embrace a certain kind of inefficiency that actually improves the social connectedness. That's not something that when people talk community, they sometimes don't think about, but in practice, that actually is the case, that your neighbor now has some sort of obligation. You have an obligation to them, and they have a certain call on you. So,
and dependence. Increase in dependence on each other.
I've got a bunch of ideas rattling around in my head, so I hope I can focus on one. I live in a high-rise cooperative, and we built it, let's see, going on 13 years ago. At the beginning, those of us who signed in early became the developers, and we helped to create the building. And therefore, we helped to create the community within this high-rise. So we refer to ourselves as a vertical community. Now, after 14 years, we've got half turnover. And new people coming in aren't nearly as dedicated to the concept of community and doing their share and volunteering and things like that as those of us who created it in the first place. So there's always a dilemma as to how you get people involved and how you keep them involved with... You know, and I don't know that what the answer is going to be to it, but we're a living experiment, I think.
Yeah, and this idea of transmission of these values kind of over time is a significant one. And that is one where I think the question of religious institutions needs to be important, regardless of one's particular religious faith or lack of faith. That has been a means by which much has been transmitted in sort of the history of human culture. It's a means of transmitting that which is of value. I think one of the questions is, can we build social cohesion in our cities without religion, without religious institutions? Where has that been tried? How does that work out? If it's not religious institutions, then where does the institutional freight move along? What are the sort of the infrastructure of transmission that is required to move the values? See, you built something amongst yourselves in the messy process of getting an artifact put together called a high-rise. It's like the co-housing movement. The co-housing approach is not to say, just get the physical space right, get that template figured out, build it, and then just throw people into it. They're like, if you don't have the people actually starting at ground zero, working through the process of planning the space, thinking about it, debating it, interacting with each other, building that social kind of connectedness amongst each other, then the finished product won't work either. So the space itself is not magic. It requires a kind of an accompanying social complement to participate in that space. And I think part of our current memory about that, we forget that, you know, religious traditions and things and cultural processes have actually been a means by which that happens. And sometimes we want the thing without understanding the process that gave rise to it. And then when it falters, we sit around wringing our hands wondering why. And it doesn't work as simply as just saying, hand this over to someone else. It has to grow. So it's a real challenge. And other movements too, that kind of the founders have a certain embeddedness because they fought to be there and fought for whatever, worked together and labored. How do you pass that on to those who inherit the fruit of it without diminishing it in some way? It's a tough challenge.
Well, I think we're a high-rise community downtown, and so speaking of transit, we have as many bicycles in our parkade as we do cars. And that can become a problem at times. And now we have a 29-story building that wants to go up just down the block behind us with way more cars than we have. And there we have two high-rises and now opposite each other, a third one coming in, and all funneling into the high-level bridge at the same time of day. And it's going to be a disaster. But who wants to listen to us? Nobody.
Oh, we're sad. We're listening, Joyce. We're listening.
I'm going to raise 3 points. Perhaps I shouldn't, but you can deal with them or not as you wish. I noticed, first of all, that, of course, we're all talking about community, although you avoided that word, but I guess it doesn't. That's obviously our concept. Three problems I see. One of them, of course, is the urban sprawl, and I do a lot of work in some of the newer communities where the front street is a wide driveway enough for three cars and very little and a garage and very little opportunity to interact with your neighbors, because that's what you see when you drive or walk around those communities. Another thing, of course, is the closure of a lot of schools because of in the inner city, particularly because of lack of student population. And those schools were an excellent center for creating a community and an interaction between among families. And the third one, of course, is the decline of the religious centers, churches and so on, and my own church is experiencing that problem now because the majority of the people attending church are seniors, although there are quite a few very young children there as well, but they can't afford them. And I'm not a religious person either, but I support our church because I believe it does good things in the community and is working very hard to interact with the community and people that are not members of the church as well. There's a large number of things, including a kindergarten and other kinds of things in that facility. So we have those problems, and I think they're very immediate and practical kinds of problems. And I don't think the city council is particularly interested in trying to deal with them, particularly early fall.
Well, I mean, sprawl is it's a challenge. Despite the last few decades of planners almost wholeheartedly endorsing anti-sprawl sentiments, we have nonetheless managed to build more low-density development, unabated in most cases, which tells you, of course, that, you know, planners are not calling all the shots, as much as sometimes it seems that way, that they have an advisory role, but there are stronger forces at work, including our own preference for privacy and autonomy and those sorts of things, and, you know, the things that the market asks for that it provides for those that are asking for it. But sprawl and social connectedness is a significant challenge. Just to echo that, it's all over the place. You see this as a repeated theme. The chance that certain suburbs may end up becoming kind of the ghettos of the future because they're so expensive to maintain at those low densities. They're so socially weak. They don't have many ties at all. Not because the people there don't want them, but the space itself makes it that much more difficult. An already difficult task trying to connect in today's society is further exacerbated by the fact that the space doesn't help it at all. I live in a street in Hamilton where there's no garages. There are three-story, narrow, almost San Francisco-style homes. We spend more time out front because we don't have anywhere else. Like, even our cars or our kids, or if we've got to reprimand our children, we do so with the neighbors not far away, and we just kind of have to deal with that. So, now, that can be inconvenient. It's high social friction at times, but the upside means we also, many of us are friends or beginning to be friends, or in others we just at least know who we are and what we are, and there's something good about that proximity. That proximity alone is not the solution, though, let me say that. It's just that sometimes a spatial arrangement can make it harder or can help kind of push us along in terms of our connectedness. The other thing about, I think, schools is a very important piece as well. L.J. Hanifin in 1916 wrote a paper about the school as community center. And in it he suggested, this was a rural setting, that a school could have an extremely important function in knitting together the very somewhat isolated social family units in the Appalachians and the air in West Virginia where he was working. And he said, if you bring them together and start helping them work on projects together, something significant will begin to happen. And so he did that himself as a superintendent, and then he sort of put this forward as a model, suggesting in that already at that stage a very clear sense that schools are not just about transmitting education or knowledge into the heads of students, but function as a very important social entity that goes well beyond just that function alone, although it needs to fulfill that function. So in my neighborhood, when they looked to close a school, I went to a meeting and asked, what is the social impact in our community of closing the school? Like, what will change in the fabric of our neighborhood if this community center type school, if it's no longer there, what's the impact? And the school board, I mean, the trustees, they said to me, and the school board administration said, well, we have no idea. If you could provide some research, that would be great, but we don't even ask. I mean, that's just not a question we even ask. But you're noting that, in fact, it is one of those contributing factors, and those institutions have a significant role to play. And part of the social infrastructure question is, are we actually taking stock of that in a serious way, not in a anecdotal kind of off the cuff, but seriously attending to those impacts.
The church. And the church?
And the church in a very similar way. There's a study being done now, well, a group out of UPenn. They're kind of looking at a single line saying, what's the economic impact of having a church in your neighborhood? Is it negative, positive? Now, they're saying there's more to church than that, but along purely economic lines, what's the impact of having a church in your neighborhood? And the studies they did in Pittsburgh, and now they're doing different cities in the U.S., and now possibly one in Toronto, their suggestion is it's a significant positive impact. So regardless of whether you share their beliefs or think they're crazy or they're on the track, but as a sociological entity, as part of your community fabric, you know, they have at least even a financial impact that's positive. There are many other impacts that are non-financial that are significant in terms of the role they play. We did a kind of a sketch study in 2006 in Toronto asking the question, if we removed religious institutions from a given neighborhood, what would the impact be? And our provisional sense of that was the answers are not very bright. It's the capacity that you would lose that's not often paid attention to would be significant. So, again, regardless of whether in particular that group or this group is what one would align with, as a part of kind of the social fabric, if we talk about that, or the social kind of energy of our community, the social functions, they have been playing a role. If they go away, is there something else replacing it that's as robust and as capable? And as of now, it seems unlikely to be the case.
Another mechanism for generating social energy, particularly in Edmonton, I understand, is the community leagues, which in my limited reading, it seems to be that Edmonton has been in the forefront of the community league movement. And I don't know why that is. If that's true, I don't know why it is that Edmonton particularly has developed such a network of effective community leagues. Could you comment on that?
They are known for that. My question would be, are the community leagues equally vital in all across all of their sort of various representations? Have they changed over the years? You know, are they growing, declining, adapting, and adjusting, fulfilling the roles that they started with? What does that look like? Because, you know, I mean, Putnam's work, this is the classic kind of space, you know, Putnam's work on bowling alone, which was looking at an important piece of social capital building was the number of and intensity of your civic memberships. So are you part of, you know, the Rotary? Are you part of a bowling league? Are you part of all of these different kinds of organizations, a church, or it could be the library society, or who knows, all of those things. And he had noticed a decline coming out of the 1950s that there was a significant drop in membership in those kinds of institutions. So I think there are many great models of that sort of building that social fabric. But sometimes the question is, are they actually functioning in a vital way, or are they declining? What happens, for instance, when I was in Beggarville, you've got the Elks Club, and you had numerous other clubs that had done fantastic work in the community for decades, a long time. There was stalwart, you know, people by really substantial, committed citizens. But their problem was they were all over 70, and there was nobody coming up behind picking that up. So there was nothing wrong with the institution, their function, their aspirations, and what they were doing. There was just nobody kind of coming in to build it back up. So my question about the league, the Edmonton Community Leagues, how is that going? How has it been attended to? What challenges are they facing, and what might be done? Those kinds of functions are absolutely essential. I mean, they're critical if you can make them work, but they have to have people. Like, there has to be sort of that investment, not unlike the condo question of a certain segment owned it, grew it, did significant things, but if it's not transferable, you know, down the line, then a noble organization can have a very, you know, unhappy ending. So maybe someone else here can comment on that. I don't know what the state of Edmonton's community leagues as far as their diversity.
I won't try to monopolize the conversation, but I have quite a bit of experience recently about community leagues versus homeowners associations, which are very prevalent in the newer communities. I participate in a group that's a steward of a Hudson Pond in the south side of the city, which is one of the only natural ponds left in the city. And that community members have to belong to the homeowners association. It's mandatory, and they pay to that association. That has taken away their interest, I guess, in belonging to the community league. Now, I live in an older community that has a very active, and that's in the Valley View area, very active community league, all kinds of things going on there. Laurier Heights, which is south, and I also belonged to earlier. Now, those older areas, I think, in this city, have, in many cases, a very active community league, a very positive influence on that area. But the Homeowners Association and the fact that they have to pay dues, the builders require it, has really drained the impetus to really belong. So I don't know if they have a comment on that or not.
Yeah, that's a great observation, because the mechanisms by which communities or organizations are formed are often extremely telling in terms of how long they last, the kind of work they do. If it's an obligation based on economics, you have to pay to be part of it, or you have to be part of a certain group to be in it, or some sort of predetermined function like that, it has sometimes can have a very different quality than if it's something that is what we might say is a more strong common good motivation. So is the homeowners association's core motivation the common good, or is it the protection of property and the making sure that real estate values stay high and ensuring that anomalies of one kind or another don't undercut the investment everyone's made in their properties? So it's probably the latter. So the question is, how can we, again, the fostering of that common good, that civic sensibility and both obligation and freedom and responsibility, and how they tie together remains extremely critical. Lots of people are asking the question of whether that's being replaced in younger generations. Is it taking different forms? Are we just not seeing it right? It's there. It's burgeoning. It's doing all sorts of things. We're just measuring the wrong thing, and eventually we'll catch up to the new trending and see that they're actually picking it up in new ways. They're not continuing the bowling league, but they're starting something else. So it's just a different thing, but there's still a lot of it around. I don't think we can answer that question yet. I think it remains an important unanswered question in many respects. Some of it's transferring, but some of it's not. And you're seeing, cases where there's lots of slacktivism. I can vote on my phone or support something with my thumb, but I'm not actually getting out and getting into the community and building something substantial over years and years and years and sacrificing to do so. That's a whole other matter. So we have to ask some of those questions too.
Well, it seems to me the elephant in the room is population size and population mobility. One of the things that seems to have happened with our cities is they've grown to huge, huge sizes, and they're continuing to grow at incredible rates. And the other thing is that the people within them are constantly on the move. They don't stay in any one place long enough to, really make a quote-unquote community. Children get bused to school, miles away from their neighborhood. People go where the work is, which means at any given time they pick up and go away to a totally different world. People now, there are snowbirds in Canada. People will go away for whole huge chunks of the year and live in totally different areas. In order to have a community, it seems to me you have to have groups of people there, almost from birth to death in the same location, making long-term commitments to each other and the place they live. Whereas the cities we have now, there's no commitment to anyone or any specific place.
Well, I mean, there's other historians in the room who could probably answer this more adequately, but there have been other sort of seasons of life, even in Canada, where the mobility of working people was quite significant. So even in the city of Hamilton, you look in the 1800s, and we think sort of people moving around is just more of a contemporary kind of phenomenon. But at that time, there was a high level of worker transients, even around sort of the industrial cities in the Victorian era as well. So I think mobility, certainly the question of continuity. So what does that persistence look like? and can you build a community without it? We, back to the technology question and kind of our allure of technology, we tend to think that technology offsets the downside of not being geographically or physically present with each other. So I can move across the country and say I'll still stay in touch with my family because we have telephone, we have various means of staying in touch, and so the offsetting negative impact of moving away is less. I think we might not be quite right about that, and to your point, which is it may not provide the kind of counter fiber that we need. Can we have lasting, substantial sort of communities and cities where we don't stay more than a couple of years or 2 or 3 years or, you know, because of our changes in income or other things or our children's needs, we moved around to different parts of the city? I don't know if maybe some here could speak to that in their own experience of if that's possible with higher mobility to continue to foster community, or whether community is sort of durable in a kind of interesting way that people can move in and out of it and it still persists, because that's also true. So you it's kind of like Neurath's ship, right? You kind of replace piece here and there and you can move it around without interrupting its function. So I don't know. I don't know what role it will play, you know, if that's... Because the flip side for me is I'm thinking of examples of people who've lived in the same neighborhoods for a long time but still never bothered to connect with each other. So we can be physically proximate in a kind of... Yeah, we're on the same street. I ran into a lady last year who lives a block over from us, and she's late 80s, early 90s. And I mentioned to her, oh, you know, the couple who are also about that same age, two streets over. Like, I knew them, I knew her. She's like, I don't know who they are. So the fact that they lived a block away from each other on the same street, just kind of two over, you know, they had never crossed paths, never met. And so in that sense, their physical proximity didn't mean actual community connection. So I don't know. I think it's a good question. How do those dynamics play out? Maybe there's some other thoughts about that.
What about Tony's suggestion about that, if I understood him correctly? I mean, you could use the Cuban model where you can't move until you get the right permit. I'd be game for that. The despot in me likes that, actually.
I think one other thing we have not addressed is the individual perception of society. One of the things that really amazes me all the time today, if I take public transport, there is nobody talking to each other. 40 years ago, you would strike up a conversation with a normal stranger. Today, they're all plugged in, or they're texting. So it's not so much a question of proximity or what we can do to improve the social fabric, but it's what can we do to improve the culture of our society. We tend to be a little bit like ostrich, if you want, put our head under the sand and pretend that nobody else exists, or porcupine, roll into and just expect that every stranger is an enemy. And I think it's a state of mind. That's my point, anyway.
Do you try to militate against that?
Sorry?
Do you try to militate against that?
Yeah.
Do you do things differently? Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good.
But this day I cannot move very far.
One of the social experiments that we've done with our children, which is a bit countercultural, I know, and perhaps will be... you know, sued for it at some point in the future, is that we didn't provide them with cell phones. In fact, they can't have them until they're 18 and on their own can decide to have one. And we were reminded many times of how barbaric that is, them being the only students in their classes that don't have cell phones of any kind. And we have a further barbarism that we introduce, which is when you walk into our house, you put your cell phone on a little ledge by the door just as you do your keys, and it doesn't come with you into the house as a general rule. It just sits there. If you need to go use it, that's fine. You go stand by the door and use it, but it doesn't kind of come into our space, in part because as a family, it's a very microscopic kind of response back, but a sense that there are things among us that can facilitate connectedness when we're together, and there's other things that can actually mitigate against it and undermine it. And so our experiment has been, as parents, to say, we think this one might be undermining certain aspects of our family life, and so we're going to set this aside, not because of any theory we read, just almost an instinctive sense that technology will be our servant but not our master, and the leash is about this long, and that's kind of where it goes, and we have one computer and we don't have wireless, and I know that will also be shocking to you. I'm sorry to be so blunt about that, but it's a way of kind of thinking about how the technology around us either is going to help us be better at our connections, our social depth and richness, or is it going to do something else to us? Because we have other friends for whom they each have their device. They're sitting in the living room. They're all together, but everyone's doing their own thing, and it's completely quiet. And our kids, when they go over and visit places like that, find it very odd because our house it's noisy. It's animated. There's a lot of kind of interaction because we don't have the distraction of something else to provide that. So we maybe just out of sheer boredom, we just interact with each other because there's nothing else for us to do. So, but public transit, you could see that too. You know, you often see that as well. I walk around downtown Toronto sometimes, and people are looking down. They stop at a street corner anywhere, and you immediately have your phone out and you're looking down. You're not even hardly paying attention to, you know, what's going on in the city around you. And by contrast, I was at a conference in Montreal. I'm not saying Montreal is better overall, but I just noted to a colleague as we're walking, look how noisy this sidewalk is. Like, it was noisy. People were talking, and it was just a normal kind of weeknight walking downtown Montreal. But for whatever reason, it caught my attention that the audible conversation level was significantly higher. I said to him, I have never heard this in Toronto. Like, I've in general kind of sidewalk walking, not at a festival or something, but just in the general kind of ebb and flow of life. That's anecdotal. It may not be true, but it is one of those things I think would argue in support of what you're suggesting, that there are things that maybe mitigate against our kind of connectedness.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's pointed out between us is that, well, what you describe is certainly the case. I mean, I certainly have seen that as well. And I can think back when I was a kid here in the 50s, every third person on Jasper Avenue would nod or say hello to you on a Saturday morning. That was common. So part of that perhaps is scale and some sense of common culture. But it's interesting. I went and lived in Chicago for 10 years. And frankly, when I came back from Chicago, I found Edmonton, which was then in a boom period. So that's worth taking a note of. I found Edmonton extremely cold, not physically cold, but socially cold, compared to Chicago, which is huge, but which has a very large black population. And the culture within that community was so different. I lived on the west side of Chicago briefly, and, well, you know, it's this issue of density. It was extraordinary. But you couldn't walk from one corner to the next without being known and your family history being known down the streets of the West Side ghetto, certainly if you were white, which I was at the time. My black period came a little later. But it's interesting that some of these things, not all of them by any means, but some of them have to do with scale, and some of them have to do with the general kind of culture that's there. But the plugged-in part is a stunning part of the new landscape.
But another interesting thing, for a while I lived very close to the promenade. I don't know if you know where that is. It overlooks the river valley, and it's a beautiful place to walk up and down. And it's very interesting because I make it a point to say good morning or how are you or just some stupid thing. And it's interesting to see the reaction. Some people look at you like, my God, what the hell are you doing? And they're about my same age. It's not a question so of age or... And then some people, you know, are just as friendly, or some people just nod. But so again, I go back, it's a cultural thing. Cultural meaning is something we have learned or something we believe in. And I think to some extent it may go back to the old idea, a stranger is an enemy. Not a stranger is a potential friend of something we can discover. And this may be, I don't know, a bit prejudiced, but goes back to our British background, I don't know.
I thought maybe it was the Englishman's problem.
Yeah, just backing this discussion up, I remember when I was a child,
and my parents used to take me into New York City. And the thing that we always remarked on was how nobody ever spoke to each other in the subways. I mean, you just sat there. Maybe you had a newspaper, you know, in front of you and protecting you from the rest of the people in the subway. But, you know, it strikes me that although maybe technology has made this worse, it's a bit part and parcel of city life that the people that you associate with are not people that you meet in your ordinary perambulations or commuting. I mean, it's people that you have some sort of common interest with, and they may be scattered all over the city, right? And you get together with them occasionally, maybe at somebody's home or maybe at a pub or at a restaurant and that sort of thing. So you don't draw your connections from your locality or even the way in which you commute back and forth. It's your connections are made on a completely different basis. And that's what separates, or one thing that really separates a city from a community, it seems to me. I think there is a kind of a adversarial relation, if you can put it that way, between city life and community life. They're really two quite different styles of life, and city life basically dissolves community life and replaces it with a lot of other connections that people form on their own, or artificial sorts of things like the senior centers, for example, which bring, like the senior center that I go to for lunch every once in a while. I mean, it's people come to it from all over. You know, it's not as though they come to it from the just the local area. So I'm not putting that down. I mean, it just seems to me that that's really part of the idea of a city.
Yeah, I think, and that's an important observation because anybody that's, I mean, even growing up in a rural community, you know, there's sometimes a sense of the idyllic in the rural. And if only we could kind of get back to that kind of village-type feel in our cities, we'd be better off. But if you've lived in those places, you know that sometimes the hatreds and animosities can run generations and can be extremely intense. And in fact, I look back to where I grew up and see some of the expressions of violence and other things that have happened there. And when you can't choose, in a certain sense, options, and when you can't diffuse some of the social tensions by making other choices, it's sometimes for those who can't leave or don't want to leave, it creates a kind of intensity that cannot be not very healthy. And in cities, we have a greater, we can have, it's not always true, but we can have sometimes a greater range of sort of selectively picking which elements we want to be part of. So I think it is, maybe the question is that a creative tension or is it a pathology or is it an advantage? You know, how do we work that out? And are there clearly are times when it seems as if it's a negative thing. There's times when it seems very positive and there's times when it's sort of in the midst, you know, you're not quite sure. And cities are those perplexing puzzles where probably all three of those things and many other variations are true, where you can find examples of where that's true. So that's a good question, a good reminder, I think, to say that it's not necessarily de facto always just a case where the proximity is the only question. Yeah. Interests and other things are important. And I know I value that in cities, that I can find somebody who's probably has some of my peculiar interests, and we might be able to get together, and that might not have been true up in Beaver Lodge where I grew up. So
I'd like to just push at that a little bit. What it seems to me you're describing, Martin, is obviously not community. And you made that distinction nicely. To my mind, one of the great benefits of community, sort of natural community, is difference. There are people in different economic brackets, people doing different kinds of things, people who understand the world in distinct ways. And at the same time, there are some common wells that they draw water from. So they really need to brush against each other. They need to engage each other periodically. So the modern city, there are places in the modern city where that exists. But increasingly, the modern city has become ghettoized. And we actually do this now in very large scale. We build suburban areas. We build various campuses. We define who can live there, not just economically, but also in terms of their aesthetic sense and a whole range of other things. So that increasingly we impose that kind of pattern, and it's a pattern driven largely, at least initially it would appear, from economic points of view. I'd like to flip that around. What if we were to see the value of real difference in a given neighborhood? So in the old Strathcona neighborhood plan that I had a fair bit to do with a long time ago, we made a real effort to see that that community would remain open and possible for people along the whole economic stream, to see that there would be group homes in that neighborhood, to see that there were that students could live there, and that there could be high rises too. You could have well-off people and people not so well-off. That was deemed a kind of ultimate value, and we captured that around the term conviviality. There will be some conviviality here, the meeting of different life, different kinds of life. But the modern, I mean, what drives Edmonton now seems to be quite different than that. But what if we were to flip that around? And what is the benefit of that? What's the gifts in that? Or aren't there any?
Well, I think, you know, you're right in many ways. But what I wanted to sort of point out was that people... it's not exactly ghetto because it's not based on locality, but people group together according to similarity of interest, similarity of class backgrounds.
They don't make the turn.
Right. So, I mean, you know, academics get together and usually without very many non-academics there, and this goes on. So you get this kind of social ghettoization. Without actual ghettoization of locality, although, of course, there's some of that going on as well. I think, you know, you often use the metaphor of the silos, and I think people get into their own peculiar silos in the city, not based on locality, but of interest, class, similarity of education, etc. And yeah, I think that's dangerous. I mean, people don't realize what the problems are in the other silos and what people in these other silos have to face.
And then just to finish the thought in a practical way, I mean, here in Edmonton, recently, the Macaulay-Boyle area, I knew people who went and lived there. The people that I knew were all people who did it out of some sense, drawing also on their understanding of what their religious faith suggested how they ought to live. And they've worked there now for 40 years to see that neighborhood could become a place that's a bit more safe, a place where a great variety of people could live. And they've been, I mean, others here may know this far better than I, but they've been, you know, modestly successful at that. So what happens? Dang. The tax system is used on property to see that a lot of those people can no longer live there.
Yeah.
So this is a problem of a kind of systemic destruction of the diversity of the human community. So,
well, this is a somewhat related topic, but I'd like to address the relationship between social structures and communities and the built environment, the developer. And I have two things particularly in mind. It has often struck me, I live in the center, more or less, of the city.
You are the center of the city.
we're very close. And it has often struck me that the center of the city is not very child-friendly. Nobody seems to have thought of a way of constructing buildings or groups of buildings that might encourage people with children to live in town. If I were doing it, my instinct would be to go for courtyards. Most of our architects don't seem to have understood the idea of a courtyard. And a building is a square that you plunk down on a piece of land, and then you get another piece of land and put another square on it.
Strategic holes in it.
Yeah. I think there's something there that our developers have to answer for. And I live in a high rise, and we have so-called social room. And one of my neighbors commented a little while back that it wasn't the sort of place where you wanted to spend time. It has its uses, but they're limited. It doesn't actually encourage a sense of community. And I think I could say that neither of these questions addresses the aesthetic of urban architecture. Against that, of course, there are beautiful cities full of churches in which, in the Middle Ages and since, people have fought each other tooth and nail, and they knew each other well, and they hated each other's guts.
Yeah.
So you don't really want to encourage that. Perhaps I'll stop there and invite comments. Has anybody... No, I'll add just one other thing. Once upon a time, I was staying in London, and there's a in Hackney, which is not a tourist area, and the Dalston Road was the junction between a development of the 1820s, which had rather pleasing brick terraced houses, and a development of the 1950s, which was a city in the sky and was the most inhuman place that I've ever seen in an otherwise civilized environment. They really hadn't solved the problem there.
We have to break for to recharge your tea and what have you. I'll just leave you with the notion that Nicholas and I are both, we have a little organization for the trying of heretics. And on our first list is... Our first list is architects. So if you want to join, I think Prince Charles is part of it as well, as I recall. Thank you, Milton. 10 minutes or so, and then we'll come back. Good. We have another half hour or so. So I'd like Shams to kick it off.
Thank you. Thank you, Milton. It's really been a good Saturday morning to have a discussion. Two or three things that I want to bring up. One is starting with what Tony talked about, community, and the other one is motor cars, automobiles. I'd just like to ask a general question to the whole audience up here. I drive back and forth to work quite often, especially when it's cold. On a bus stop, I'll see people. Should I pick up somebody or should I not? You know, sometimes I have and I've been rebuffed. Sometimes people have accepted. Sometimes I'm also a little scared as to whether should I pick up somebody, because, you know, it's like Vittorio said, you know, stranger is somebody that you should be scared of and not...
That's
so, I mean, you know, what is the protocol on, you know, giving somebody a ride downtown, especially when it's really, really cold? You know, that's the sort of first thing about community. The other thing is, a few years ago, you know, we talked about human scale. I think that's really important. Some years ago, actually, I happened to be in three very varied places not far from in a short period of time. One was the Umayyad Mosque in the, Damascus. A large space. But, you know, when I was there, I didn't feel overwhelmed by the space. Then I went to the Cathedral of Eli. Again, large space, tall space, but not an overwhelming space. And then I happened to be in Rockefeller Center in New York. And you enter the foyer, and it's like you're completely diminished by the entire space. So, you know, that's a completely different, these three, two similar and one completely different kind of space that happens to be part of our so many different communities in different cities. And coming to what you were saying about how space, you know, human scale is so important in the architecture. And running into that, I also want to ask you, we've talked about religion, this whole, not just this series, but a whole number of series before. And there's either an aggression or a defensiveness about the topic as to what to do with it, whether it will continue to be alive in 10, 20, 100 years. What is the difference in your research that comes across? What is the difference between a polity and a religious community? You know, because if you look at Walmart, for instance, it destroys communities wherever they go, irrespective of whether religious or political. The very idea of, you know, small shops, mom and pop stores maybe, it destroys them. And then takes up their space? So that's sort of two or three questions that I'm going to throw out. There's another one, but I'll come to that later if you have time.
Well, maybe I'll take a swing at a couple. Maybe others can join in on some of them. Regarding the space, like whether spaces diminish us or are useful to us or make us somehow enrich us, we just were having a conversation at the end of the break, and I've been reflecting about this a bit this morning as we've been talking. And, you know, to what extent is the space responsible, you know, for the social interaction? So how responsible can we hold a space for whether the interactions in it are good or not, whether they're community building or whether they're detrimental? And maybe we could use the examples. We were chatting about Churchill Square here in Edmonton. So different opinions about, is that a good development? Was it poor? Is the design good for, you know, building civic engagement and sort of a sense of pride in Edmonton and a sense of connectedness and a place to go and be the city together, not just in our own little spaces, but kind of in mass, en masse in some respects. And I don't know what you think. Is what if people don't want to do that? What if the space itself is fine? There's nothing, it could be used that way, but people simply aren't in the habit, culturally or otherwise, of actually engaging and making use of that space. Is it entirely the fault of the design of that square that people do or don't use it, or are there other factors at play? And how would we determine that? I think sometimes I see things that make you can go too far one way and suggest that you have only to get the space right and everything else follows. And there are times that I think that's a little too optimistic. I don't think that's actually true in some cases. There are others where people desperately want to connect and there's a strong impulse to connect, but there's no space that makes it easy. And there you find them connecting anyway, breaking rules, doing little ad hoc kind of things they set up. Some of the street guerrilla urbanism you see where people just sort of start setting up lawn chairs in the middle of the street and kind of close it off. Well, there's a good indication where there's actually cultural and social energy that wants to connect, but the space has been so poorly designed it mitigates that at every turn, finally people say, enough, we're just going to make our own barrier. We're going to play road hockey on the street, even if it's illegal in our city, and we don't really care who, you know, come and arrest us. I mean, that happens in Hamilton sometimes. Technically, it's illegal to play street hockey on the street, but people in our neighborhood, they just do it all the time. And so far, nobody's been arrested. But those are the kinds of things that... So I think when we think of the relation between space and the building of community and social kind of weaving, there's not a simplistic divide. You don't get one right and the other follows, or the other, you know, vice versa. That we have to think about how we develop these together. And back to the high-rise question, part of this is that when we deliberate together and work on these kinds of questions, the very process of engaging with them prepares us for the use of those spaces over the long haul. And that kind of civic process is something we should just, I think we increasingly have to kind of learn to just grow into and continue to see that as essential to the thing itself. It's not just an end we have in mind, But the way that we get there ensures that, that something lasting actually takes place. So I'd like to leave that as a question. You know, is the square itself over there responsible for its use or misuse? You're here year-round. You know how it gets used or not. That'd be interesting to hear some reflections on that. And if there's even interest in that space being used for things other than formally organized events where people come because they, you know, paid for a ticket for a concert or they're giving away, you know, free beer and pickles or whatever the case may be that kind of gets people out. The question of the bus stop might be a more simple one. I mean, some places it's illegal, or you could, you know, get in trouble for sort of soliciting people at a bus stop. You know, you're not actually supposed to stop and talk to them. The other question might be how fast you're driving towards them when you go to pick them up. That might be, you know, a dissuader or not. I don't know. I don't know. You know, some people have pointed out that, you know, the social value we've created around those sorts of public, like bus stops, means that to stop and ask somebody, for most people that would seem, that's such an unusual thing, that you're probably not going to get past the default setting. I suppose if somebody looked like they were freezing to death or something was going on and you stopped to offer assistance, that would be different. But in the normal course of things...
Yeah, because it's very cold temperatures. I mean, you know, sir, very cold temperatures, especially close to Christmas. You know, it's not a problem. You know, stop and say, sure, I'll take a ride, you know.
Sure.
Just drop them downtown. You know, it's not a big issue. But on a day like this, I generally would not stop. But, you know, I sometimes think about it and say, no, I shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, because I talk to younger people, including my nephew, who's much younger. Would you, you know, take a ride? No, I wouldn't. So, you know, straight away, and I know that, you know, if
but
I...
he's your nephew.
I know, but no, but if he said somebody else stopped on the street,
yeah,
you know, a car stopped and asked him whether he wanted a ride, he said, I wouldn't take a ride.
Well, it used to be, I mean, hitchhiking, now we've gotten so used to the fact that you just don't do it.
Exactly.
But I remember when I was younger that picking up hitchhikers was quite normal. I mean, my dad would do that, we would do that. I've done it myself many times. You know, I just don't, I mean, you use your discernment when and how and all those sorts of things, but, you know, we see that as a kind of common good thing. In Hamilton, my youngest and middle daughter were standing at a bus stop because they take transit there, and they were at a bus stop. It was raining hard, pouring rain, and waiting for the bus, and a car pulls up, and it's one of our neighbors. We don't know them really well, but they know us, they know our kids, you know, and stopped and asked, can we give you a ride home? So they knew the bus would come, but like you, they saw that this is a peculiar circumstance where it's pouring rain and they're standing out waiting by themselves, and they stopped and gave them a ride and brought them home, and everything was fine. And in that sense, that was it's a great kind of civic moment, right? Or just human decency to sort of say, we know who you are, we'll attend to you. There's enough trust for that to take place. There might be other circumstances where that works badly, but I think the general sense, the risk is more that, not that they will be the enemy, but that they will actually be someone to help you. So,
what about the question of religion and polity?
Yeah. Well, I think religious expression is a particular kind of, you know, social and a certain special kind of entity. I suppose it might depend on its context or what facet of it we're talking about. So today I've been talking a lot more about sort of the religious expression as an institution or as an organization in the municipal landscape. So that's only one very thin level or thin way of looking at a religious expression. So is the entity a registered Canadian charity, for instance? Does it have legal status? Does it occupy land? Does it have a building? That sort of thing. I've kind of been talking about religious institutions in that way. So just to point out a pragmatic reality that they do exist in that form, and in cities we have to contend with them in that form. They have needs. They have a role to play. They are somewhere. So I'm not sure at what level I can sort of maybe approach it, or maybe others if I can.
I guess what I was trying to get to is with the idea of community. Yeah. Both of them are centripetal forces which bring together communities, whereas the economy is a centrifugal force, or capitalism is a centrifugal force that breaks them apart. So in a sense, they're both, quote-unquote, allies, you know, in today's world where everything is, the bottom line is money, finance, you know. So maybe there's something there, I don't know, then your research you may have come across, you know, as community-building forces rather than as forces which are centrifugal to each other?
I would suggest a line that would be of interest maybe to run down would be the extent maybe to which certain religious practices in our culture and even expressions at institutional levels begin to look as commodified as Walmart. So, you know, are there settings in which it's actually quite hard to distinguish between the choice I have as a consumer at Walmart and the choice I have as a religious consumer at whatever particular sort of space I'm at. In that case, I would say they maybe don't have as much difference as we would hope, but that's only some overlap in that space. I think the religious dimension in its fullest sense is a far richer and more significant kind of experience within an organizational setting than would be the case in an economic exchange where I'm simply going to buy bread or peanuts or something of that nature. But I wouldn't discount the mercantile or commercial or economic side of that's a necessity as well. They do very different things. The problem comes when we sometimes perhaps confuse them or treat them from a municipal level as the same thing. They just produce a different widget. One produces potato chips and the other one produces religious people or education. And sometimes at some municipalities it seems almost treat them. They're just the same kind of thing with just a slightly different output. And that, I think, confuses the significant difference that they have for polity versus religious institutions.
One role that religion doesn't play anymore is being a focus for sort of the highest values that the society holds. As soon as you go to cities in Europe, at the center of every city in Europe is a dome or a cathedral. An immense amount of civic effort has been poured into building that, centuries ago, of course. But you can see how it provided this kind of focus for the for a kind of effort that involved a lot of money, a lot of work, a lot of artistic energy in the city. And that must have been important in the unity of that city. I don't see as we have anything to replace that, and I'm wondering whether that has made the city quite a different thing now.
Oh, right.
I see. Right. Okay. I had thought maybe the art gallery was sort of served that. At the center of Edmonton, but we've got this other thing, right?
We're going to use Meyer on it shortly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah. I wonder whether something hasn't been lost here. I'm not at all trying to argue for a recovery of religion as a central focus for society. Once you lose that central focus, well, maybe the result is that you find these other sort of trivial foci and build around that. I remember when, again, the first really big city that I encountered as a boy was New York. And we used to go in there occasionally. And I remember how impressed I was with Rockefeller Center. Somebody else mentioned that. But, it really was, I think, trying to fill that sort of gap that had been left by religion, and in this case it was the whole world of finance and business. When you look at that famous statue in Rockefeller Center, it's having a kind of quasi-religious import, that's for sure.
Maybe the two of you could develop this, since you both are showing some theological interest. Just to remind you that Rockefeller Center is built by a Baptist. So when we compare that to the Great Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, as Shams said, when you go in, you do not feel diminished. When you go into Rockefeller Chapel, you feel something quite different than what you feel at the Umayyad Mosque. Is there a theological issue here? You share something with the Baptists. You want to reflect on this?
Well, I mean, for myself, my experience in different spaces like that is I usually feel it as a kind of richness, the complexity of what's there. The one is imaginative in a certain dimension. It has, I would say, qualities, in some spiritual places that are much stronger across many facets. Some of the ones aimed maybe more significantly at kind of impressing you through their sheer size or their sort of intimidation alone is intended to be just that, a kind of intimidation, a kind of a recognition that, there's reason why that's so large and you, by contrast, are so small. The other one is a more of a substantive engagement. It also is something very large, something numinous even, but it's not so much to expel me as it is to become part of it, to join in with it. It's invitational. That's not true of all religious spaces. Some of them do have a feeling of off-putting. They are a kind of, they feel cold or they feel distant or they just feel severe, and that's also possible. That is a dimension of religious experience as well. But the commercial side is usually, it oddly sometimes seems to try to pick, sort of selectively pick things out of the rich historical vocabulary, visual or spatial or otherwise, and sort of selectively sort of utilize them, but often in a way that feels slightly bastardized or sort of kitschy, or it's like a cheap imitation. It's imitating the form without understanding what gives rise to that. And that's the thing that sometimes in some spaces I would feel a reaction against, that doesn't feel quite genuine somehow. It doesn't feel truthful. But that's very subjective, so others would probably see it differently.
Yeah, I have a few things to say, partly because I was born and raised in New York City, and I went to Rockefeller Center many, many, many times, especially when I was young. And to me, it was a place of joy. It was a place where there, where people were skating, usually, where there was great music, and great Christmas decorations. And as a child, I think, wow, this is so wonderful, because it's so rare in Manhattan to have access to that kind of stuff. And the statue, I remember this vividly, because it's of Atlas holding the world, a very muscular Atlas holding the world on his shoulders. And to me, as a kid, it was, wow, man can be powerful. Man can carry a large burden. And, I wasn't sophisticated enough to say and carry the burdens of the world, but that's how it struck me. It was like, this is an inspiration to you, kiddo. And I have two quick things to say about Manhattan, especially about the Tower 157 that's growing up for the billionaire, going up, but it's gone up for the billionaires. I happened to stay next to it when it was the last in Manhattan, and it was just a big hole in the ground, so I've been thinking about it and writing about it. And two things I want to bring to your attention. One is that there's a big controversy about the shadow that not only this tower creates in Central Park, but on many such buildings that are coming up in that area as we speak, that are also putting the shadow on Central Park, which, as most of you know, is the only real wooded community area that we love so much. And in the middle of the winter, Christmas time in fact, it's going to totally shadow the first, I think, quarter of that park on the south side, closest to Central Park West, south. And so there's controversy as who decides whether these guys could impose that on us. These guys, meaning Burnett, who made billions on the building and the billionaires he's building it for. And interesting enough, he had to buy airspace or sky space, what do they call it, to buy the building, to put up the building. And that to me puzzles me. How do you buy airspace? We figure ground space, but he had to buy airspace, and that might have given him also. The millionaires, billionaires who are moving into that should normally be paying $200,000 a year in just taxes, city taxes, on the units that they're buying. But instead they're paying $20,000 because of something, some legislature whereby they have to put up housing for the poorer people in New York City. It's a little bit complicated, but everybody's up in arms about that. Third and last thing, this is going to affect urban environments for time to come. And it's based on three different, a confluence of three different technologies. And it's going to sound bizarre, but one has to do with scopes and rifles. Those have become digitized now, digital technology, so that a marksman who's never practiced before basically, the computer inside this device calculates the flow of air and the distance from the target and the heat and anything else that would impact the flight of the bullet, and puts it into the sight. So thereby, if the target is in the crosshairs, but that's not the correct position, it won't let you fire, and it'll only let you fire on a different crosshair, which is going to take the bullet directly to the target, irrespective of the wind conditions and all other conditions. That exists now. The second is rifles can be fired at a distance, electronic, digitally. That's been around for a long, long time. The third thing is drones. So what's going to happen, what actually is on the net now, there's one example of this, that they have drones that take weapons into the air, and these drones can be released from anywhere. To attack a target in Manhattan, they could be released from New Jersey. And they could fly into Manhattan, to this tower, in fact, and they could target from a distance, now this sounds crazy, but of 2,000 yards. The best ones, the best rifles, 2,000 yards, and take out somebody inside one of those glass units. Huge condos, $45 million condos. So these people are sitting ducks, and they soon will be. And so this is going to affect the whole idea of take the high ground for the rich and leave the poor behind. It's going to affect the technology of building and everything. I just wanted to leave that out there because I know that that's coming. I mean, I could give citations if you need them later.
Are you a consultant to anarchists? Anarchists, yeah. This is amazing.
He's trying to hire me, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, well, charge him. Charge him.
We haven't got enough money.
I want to get this discussion back to how Edmonton can become a city that generates social energy. Now, I know there have been some things happening recently, a trend change in trend, so that there is more infill resident building, but mostly we are still pushing the boundaries out beyond, because people want a suburban lifestyle. Now, even though our city politicians, I've heard them say, yes, we need to have a better balance between building up intensive or building out and using more agricultural land. We need to have a balance. But what they mean by balance, as I have read articles, is to get it to 80% and 20%. Either that's where it is now or that's where they're trying to get it. 80% out because the demand is there, and 20% up. But that's not a balance, and that means primarily we're just going to keep on going the direction we've been going and creating a car-dependent suburban style of life. So we need to get at our politicians, and I don't believe there is really a political will sufficient to change this dynamic. At least in D.C., when they had an NDP government under Dave Barrett, they had the political courage to create, by legislation, the Agricultural Land Reserve, which was aimed at, protecting fertile land for food production. And if you own land that's in the land reserve, it's not easy to get it out. It's had a significant impact on this whole balance between pushing outward and going up. So that's what I want to see Edmonton become. I would even favor that legislation that limits the freedom to go ever more out and out and gobbling up more land. They blew it just recently when they had an opportunity to preserve huge tract of land in the Northeast, and only a small part of it is being preserved.
Can I
Can I answer part of that? I was part of, I spoke to City Council when we were trying to fight the development of Northeast. The big problem is, of course, that the developers get the jump on City Council. They buy up the land, and then it's very, very difficult to make the changes. And we can see the sprawl continuing towards the airport in the south. I grew up in Clover Bar. It's almost entirely now developed industrial. Good number one soil has been destroyed because of the wish of developing that land and the possibilities to sprawl. The area that I grew up in is gone. It's industrial. And that's what's going to happen to the good northeast soil. The good northeast soil, which is perfect for Martin Garden. It's not Market Gardens. It's number two soil, has a lot of sand in it, which means that you can. It's perfect for growing root crops. And that's going to go. And I don't know, unless people get up in arms about this kind of thing, I don't know how we can possibly counteract it.
Thank you. There are lots of different avenues that things have been going around in, and I think I'm trying to narrow it down. So we have to have a group in order to have a community. You can't not have a group. And we attribute from the conversation different things, such as culture and religion and so on and so on. If we only use human instead of all these other things, then perhaps we can narrow it down a little. And there are humans who will say, well, I don't want to live over there because they're very nosy. They keep looking in and they can know what you're doing before you've even done it. And there are others who want to live over there because it's far different culturally and I like it better. And all of these things are human things. We all have them, perhaps to different degrees. How are we going to control that? Can we control it? Is it not true, for instance, that we want to be, to some extent, independent? But there's a bit of an overlap with selfishness over there. And we have to find a way to control our own selfishness because we're not going to allow anybody else to do it. The only other people that can do it are governments and City Hall, and they do it with money. And they can very easily make groups that only have a certain amount of money to live in a certain place and so on. If you go along that route, you see that we can't do anything, I'm sorry to tell you, to change things. Unless we all change ourselves and say, well, no, I can live over there with those other people who look and are keen on knowing what's going on, or I can live over there and become more human. I don't know the answer to that, but then that brings us back to the old thing about religion. Is there anything other than religion that can control or reduce or make it less attractive to be selfish? I hate to say this because it comes up often in these discussions. As long as we have the religion of money, we won't succeed. And we will have cathedrals called, what do they call the thing? Gates' Place downtown. We have those sort of things. Hockey arenas and so on. Sorry for sounding so pessimistic, but I'm only trying to be realistic and say, how can I change things? And I can't see any way around it. Thank you.
Just a really quick comment with respect to the issue of community and what some people have seen correctly as the impersonality of the city and the difficulty of restoring a sense of community. I just like to make a plea for the usefulness of examining what happens to many cities under crisis. Because under crisis, what appears on the surface to be an impersonal, anonymous city, it's amazing the degree of resourcefulness, of latent sense of community, and just pure genius that emerges from grassroots organizations. I think if you were to speak to anyone who was in London during the Blitz, they will probably tell you how a sense of community was reconstructed under the German bombardment. I think you find, for example, in places like Oakland, when the racial tensions were greatest, And I'm not saying I agree with everything with respect to the Black Panther Party, but it's there where you see completely new developments like sickle cell anemia clinics free of charge or free breakfast programs, which were developed through a city that became in crisis. In my city, during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, in Derry, we saw the emergence of a number of grassroots organizations. One of them was called the Incident Center, where both Protestants and Catholics would come together if there was a rumor that someone had been killed or abused. The Incident Center would process that information and do everything in its power to try and discover whether this was really happening or not. And it became a mediation center. During New Orleans, during the total derogation of their responsibilities by the public authorities, grassroots organizations emerged to help transport people off of those roofs. It wasn't enough to counteract the entire problem. So I guess my plea is we have a hell of a lot to learn from cities in crisis, because all sorts of spontaneous grassroots organizations and institutions emerge. Some of them are religious, faith-based, some of them aren't. They all have a role to play, I think. The reason I think it's important in the final analysis is because our cities are scheduled to go through some tremendous crises in the future, whether it's ice storms, whether it's massive thunderstorms. We're living in a time of global warming. So we need to learn from these experiences and maybe translate them into a daily practice.
Well, a few final remarks, Milton, and we'll wrap things up.
Just pardon, love to answer and interact with many great questions and observations made, especially down towards the end as we kind of settle into the groove on some of the core themes. But I know for our part, and Cardiff as a public policy think tank, we often remark that politics is downstream of culture, so we're not pessimistic about the political process. We see it as essential to civil society. But if politics is the act of finding a parade and getting in front of it, I think there's a stronger core sense in which it's the quality and nature of our citizenship and our sense of obligation, duty, and freedom within our societies that is really a telling feature of many of these questions that we face. In the case of cities in crisis, there are occasions, even in Calgary, where during the crisis people draw together. They appreciate that. But I've also met with and talked with people for whom they say, but not long after that was done and the crisis passed, we kind of went back to doing things the way we did before. So it's a comfort that in that moment it's there. But what some people are finding is, how do we get this in a more consistent way in our day-to-day interactions? It could be interesting if we polled ourselves today and said, is the degree of social interaction, a generic or general sense of belonging in my own life, at a place where I'm content, it's sufficient, it's all that I need, or is it something which I would like to see grow or change? So at a very personal level, do I feel like the social fabric of my life is sufficiently strong and robust and enriched to a point where it's satisfactory? That's an important question, and we might ask ourselves whether we're there. A final note is about some of the changes coming to our cities, even socially, is going to be driven by some demographic changes. Where are the baby boomers going to retire? There's lots of people thinking, well, hopefully they'll retire downtown, because that would really help kind of improve density. It'd be much cheaper to service the medical needs that they will have if they're close to a central location and if they're dispersed all through suburbia. But in some cases, that doesn't look to be happening. So in Toronto, people thought, well, they'll sell their suburban homes, move into the downtowns, and in part finance their retirement by living off the differential. But that differential in some cases has now disappeared. So it'll be very interesting. Many developers are hedging a lot of money trying to guess the answer to that question. Where will the baby boomers retire? Where will some of the demographic shifts take us? Edmonton's a city that will face that as well. New people coming to Edmonton to satisfy economic growth in the drive as the oil sands and other things continue to develop, how will that shape your city? That's a very important question. Where will people retire? What parts of the cities will they find attractive? As people raise families, will they find downtown sufficiently rich to raise their children? And someone raised this question earlier. I see in Toronto people trying to encourage families to move downtown, But I'm like, unless the street quality is sufficiently strong that they would want their children to kind of be part of that, it's unlikely that having a well-furnished, three-bedroom condo for a family is going to be enough, because they will need more than that. And so if we don't get the street quality questions and public life quality questions sorted out, I don't think you're going to see a massive shift of people to downtown areas. They're going to continue going the other way, starting there as young professionals and moving out where they can. So these are some, I think, major pieces of the social fabric questions of our cities, but that we need to attend to the social infrastructure and see it and work to understand it, not assume we know it, is to me a really critical and central question that we will face for our future. Thank you for your interaction today. It's a privilege to be here.
Thanks so much, Milton.